Hello and welcome to Food Talk Radio, coming to you from the campus of Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. On today's program, two pieces from Jack Hornacle. First, he'll introduce us to a new generation of farmers. We'll find out who they are, what they grow, and how they got onto the lands that they now work. After that, Jack speaks with Mark Lapping, distinguished professor at the Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine. They'll discuss the Maine Food Strategy Initiative, a collaborative effort to build a comprehensive food strategy for the state of Maine. Then, Eric Andrews, founder of the Vermont Sail Freight Project, explains how, with his newly built barge, Ceres, he hopes to relaunch a carbon-neutral maritime economy that connects farmers and forests of Vermont with the urban markets of the lower Hudson Valley. To start off today's episode, we turn to Emily Lyons for the latest installment of our Farm Bill Watch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Farm Bill Watch. The House and Senate have been extremely busy over the last few weeks working on the passage of a new five-year farm bill. On June 10, 2013, the Senate passed a new version of the farm bill, setting the stage for a long-delayed fight in the House. The bill passed with a 66-27 vote, with 18 Republicans supporting the bill. The Senate measure promises more than $24 billion over a 10-year period in savings. The key provisions of the bill include elimination of direct payments, creation of a shallow loss program, a new dairy program based on margins, and a link between conservation compliance and crop insurance premium subsidies. On June 18th, the House of Representatives began debate on the farm bill. When the bill was introduced in the House, 230 amendments had been submitted, but the House Ag Committee rules determined that only 103 would be offered. Several of the controversial amendments include transfer of funds from the crop insurance program to food stamp program, separating the food stamp program from the farm bill, capping the amount of crop insurance subsidies that could be received, specifying federal chicken housing standards, and requiring conservation compliance to be eligible for crop insurance. Debate on the House Farm Bill ended on June 20th, followed by a vote. In a major blow to the farming community, the House rejected the proposed five-year, $940 billion bill in a vote of 195 to 234. Of the 195 votes supporting the bill, only 24 of those were Democratic votes. Most Democrats voted against the bill because of the $20 billion cut to the food stamp program over a 10-year period. The Republicans that opposed the bill stated that it was because the bill was too expensive with the current national budget deficit. The House has a few options to proceed to get a farm bill passed by September. The House could vote on the version approved by the House Ag Committee in May, or strip out some of the controversial food stamp amendments believed to have contributed to the downfall on the House floor. On June 26th, a group of Democratic representatives introduced the bipartisan Senate farm bill in the House. This move has been viewed as a non-starter with other members of the House. Lawmakers could also simply start negotiating with the Senate in conference to craft a final law, but these options would diminish the chamber's already depleted negotiating leverage. Currently, the House Republican leadership is actively pursuing a strategy of splitting the failed farm bill in two parts so the nutrition title and food stamp programs can be considered on its own. Even if successful in getting out of the House, the two-bill strategy raises parliamentary problems about the scope of the future House-Senate conference talks. If the House does not adopt a new farm bill in the next few months, the House could again vote to extend the current farm bill. The current farm bill extension expires at the end of September. However, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has said that the Senate will not pass another farm bill extension. Yet again, the fate of the farm bill is extremely uncertain, but we here at Food Talk Radio will keep you updated.
Who's farming these days? Director of Vermont Law School's Center for Agriculture and Food Systems, Lori Restino, explains the current state of things.
And America's farmers are aging. 60% are 55 or older. In addition to all this, the barriers to farming have increased. So the example of the high cost of land, and one of the reasons for that is the rising commodity prices, so land is worth more, as well as infrastructure, risk management. So what's happened is we've seen the disappearance of middle-sized farms and then the consolidation of farms to very large farms. So enter the new agrarian. So we need farmers. We have a system that really needs to be diversified. It's not sustainable the way it is currently. So who are the new agrarians and how are they different from farmers of the past? Neil Hamilton has called this new group of people, which we see here in Vermont, the cultural creatives. They're community oriented. They generally have an ethic of environmental stewardship, and there are a lot of women that have taken back to farming.
Last weekend, I had the opportunity of meeting some of these new agrarians. Joined by some other Vermont Law School students, I ventured across Lake Champlain to Essex County, New York, to attend a young farmer's solstice mixer put on by the Greenhorns. The Greenhorns are a nonprofit organization composed of young farmers with the mission of promoting and supporting the new generation of agrarians. Much of their work is collaborative, community-oriented, educational, volunteer-driven, and artistic. The Solstice Mixer, for example, was a combination of workshops, live music, delicious meals, and farm tours. We met three different greenhorns who had begun to make their new living on the farm.
My name is Ian Ader. I'm co-owner of Fledge & Crow Vegetables. We're in Keysville, New York. We farm 15 acres of naturally grown veggies. We've been doing this 6 years now, and we're having a ball if it ever stopped raining.
Ian was enthusiastic and explorative about farming. He showcased his custom-welded equipment and explained an innovative method of growing pea shoots, a crop he learned was very profitable given the demand from local chefs. Ian also showed us his compost. He took donations of Asian milfoil, an invasive species that businesses get paid to remove from nearby lakes but have nowhere to dump it. This sinuous aquatic weed is nutrient-rich and degrades in a matter of hours. It was this experimental approach that set Ian apart as a young farmer. He declared, "That's the story of me. I'm not an expert. I just love it." Next was Asa Thomas Train of Mace Chasm Farm.
This mountain behind us here is called Tremblow Mountain, and over the other side of that is Lake Champlain. So our farm is called Mace Chasm Farm. We named it after the road. There was a lot of hemming and hawing about what the name should be.
Asa, his wife Courtney, and a few other greenhorns managed this primarily meat farm. Animals on site included hens, broilers, cattle, draft horses, piglets, sows, and the biggest boar I've ever seen. Courtney butchers on site, and though they currently slaughter elsewhere, Mace Chasm is in the process of building its own USDA and state-inspected slaughterhouse. The Solstice Mixer concluded at their farm with live avant and soul music, and a bonfire the size of a house. But our last farm tour of the day was at North Country Creamery. Farmhand Stephen Guggen welcomed us.
So that's where we make the cheeses and yogurt, and we sell raw milk here as well. The property starts at this corner here, and it goes up. It's 112.5 acres. It's pretty much divided up half tillable, half wooded.
Stephen and owner Ashley tended a small herd of Jersey cows, only seven of which were currently milking. The milk is sold raw, but they also make yogurt and a number of different cheeses, the recipes for which came from the previous owner, who had built a sizable reputation at the local farmers market. Wondering how these young greenhorns came on such productive land, complete with farming infrastructure, and are able to run a profitable business?
Actually, Ashley just signed the lease on Tuesday because OSI, Open Spaces Institute, purchased the land from the Hendrons. Now Ashley is leasing the place from OSI, and she has the option to purchase at the end of 5 years. So
Ashley referred to the lease-to-own agreement, saying, "It was the best thing that could have happened to us." Coincidentally, I had run into Bob Enderberg of the Open Space Institute a few months prior at a symposium. We spoke, and he explained OSI's innovative approach to getting new agrarians onto prime agricultural land.
My name is Bob Enderberg. I'm the general counsel and vice president of the Open Space Institute.
And so what's the general work of the Open Space Institute?
OSI was founded 40 years ago, and we're engaged in land preservation. We started in New York State, but we now operate everywhere from South Canada down to South Georgia. We have a land acquisition program, which is acquired and protected over 125,000 acres in New York State. And we have a conservation finance and loan program, which has helped protect another 2.1 million acres all up and down the East Coast.
And so you were talking about these lease-to-owner arrangements. Are these a novel tool that the OSI has developed?
This is a brand new tool we've used, and we've become engaged in the last 10 years in farmland preservation, because if you want to preserve a landscape, mm-hmm. in many cases you have to preserve the farms that are part of that landscape. And it's occurred to us that in preserving land, we might also do something for the farming community. What we've done is pioneered, I think, a fairly unique product called lease-to-own for young farmers, where we find a parcel of land that we want to protect anyway because it protects scenic views. We then find a young farmer who we think is committed to the industry of farming, and we lease that farm to the farmer at a price which makes it affordable for him. And what we first do is we put a conservation easement on the farm, which lowers its value substantially because the development rights have been taken away. Mm-hmm. We then give the farmer a 5-year lease, and he has the right to buy that farm anytime during the 5 years of the lease. And the purchase price is based upon the encumbered value of the farm, reflecting the conservation easement. And a portion of each month's rent that he pays to OSI reduces the price under the option. So in effect, the farmer is earning equity in the property while he farms. Does this help young farmers? We think so, because a big barrier to entry for new farmers is acquiring land. This allows them to get into a piece of land for approximately what it would have cost them to finance it, but they don't have to borrow. And during the 5 years of the lease, they get to build equity, they get to build credit, mm-hmm. and they get to choose when they can purchase it according to when they can get access to funds. Just makes it a lot easier for a farmer. We'd like to do 15 of these in the next 5 years. And the theory is we're going to create a pool of new farmers. We're also creating a pool of buyers for lands that we have, which we put conservation easements on. So we think it's a happy intersection between land conservation and the food movement.
And so how many of these lease-to-own arrangements have you enacted so far?
Well, we've started the process up in Essex County, which is a New York county on the western side of Lake Champlain. And we've done 2 lease-to-own arrangements so far. We anticipate doing several more. And then we anticipate doing a substantial number down near New Paltz, New York, mm-hmm. down in New York's Shawangunk Mountains, where we are launching with an organization known as the Glenwood Center, a farm incubator program. And we will be teaching young people how to farm. And in theory, if they graduate from this program, we will place them on a piece of OSI-protected property, mm-hmm. which they have the right to buy. We'll also provide them with low-cost financing for purposes of soil amendments or building infrastructure and the like.
What are the qualifications for a young farmer? I mean, you say the word young, so what's the age range you're looking for, since that's part of it? And what kind of experience do they have to have?
We partner with farm organizations who are good at vetting farmers, because we're land conservationists. We're not farmers. Mm. But we're generally looking for younger people, because we want to get younger people into the field, who have a tangible commitment to farming and have already been farming somewhere.
You've touched on a lot of the benefits of the program. Are there any particular risks to it?
Well, you know, there's always a risk that the farm will fail. The farmer won't work out. But it's good for OSI because in the past we would buy a piece of land and sell it to a young farmer in exchange for debt. And if they defaulted, we had to bring a foreclosure action, which was painful for the farmer. It was painful for OSI. So it involves our tying up our capital in this property. But if the arrangement doesn't work out, we still own the farm. If the farm goes up in value, we get the benefit of that. And, of course, we are getting rent during the term of the lease. Mm-hmm. So for us, we think we're creating a market for our conserved lands, and it's a low-risk program.
Do you think this technique can be applied in other states?
Absolutely. This is not unique to New York. We might launch it in other states. And, of course, we have to raise the capital mm-hmm. to make it possible. We had a substantial donor in Essex County who made a very generous gift to OSI, which, along with using other OSI monies, made this possible. But we're going to look to expand the model. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Every box, and then I've run out of boxes, and this will cave in one day, but...
That's Mark Lapping of the Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine in Portland, showing me his collection of research and reports that have influenced his Maine Food Strategy Initiative. He explains.
Well, it follows very, very closely on the model established by the farm-to-plate strategy in Vermont, though it's different in a number of ways. Ours is a bit more extensive because we're a lot larger. Where Vermont is 600,000 folks, we're about 1.3. And geographically, we're frankly immense for an eastern state. And then, too, we've added the seafood sector, which is not only fish, but lobsters, and also aquaculture, which is pretty strong in the state as well. So ours looks different, feels different, smells different, walks different, but in many ways we've learned a great many lessons from the Vermont approach.
I'm sorry, how should I refer to it?
It's a strategy right now.
Okay.
We don't know really what to call it. We'll probably have a contest.
Okay.
For a logo, for a name, for a t-shirt.
Yeah. I guess that's just it. So the strategy at this point is to make the in-state connections to solidify that system. And I saw that some of the next steps are to connect players that should be dealing with each other, yep, and make sort of working groups and have this sort of
session. It's really to tighten the weave and also to find out what are the gaps. Why is it difficult for us to have more cold storage facilities? What can we do about that? How do we go about supporting more abattoirs? Because Maine's just got incredible grass, and this is a terrific state for beef, poultry, lambs, almost any dependence that would be, if you will, free range or really grass fed. And how do we turn that from fattening up the animal to actually processing and then distributing?
So part of the strategy would be actually to expand Maine's, agricultural footprint.
Well, yeah, I'd say the whole entire food footprint and food infrastructure. Now, here we sit in Portland, and the city has a phenomenal reputation for good restaurants. And a lot of them really source local food. They want more and a greater variety of local food. It's one of the features of Maine cuisine. And we'd like to see that not only appear in great restaurants, but in our schools, our universities, our prisons, other institutions, more Maine-grown and Maine-harvested food.
And I was reading in some of your literature that there were prior state initiatives to make a sort,
yes,
of comprehensive food plan, but
yep,
they were either too commodity-focused or outright didn't include seafood or had other sort of fatal flaws.
Yeah, and I think a number of them also just simply ran out of gas. This is, I think, a different time that requires a different effort. And we found just a great deal of support. I think it's because people understand that food systems have an awful lot to do not only with the food we consume, but really with economic conditions. And in a very poor state like Maine, that's really quite important. You know, we're the worst in New England in terms of food insecurity. One out of every four children under 16 years of age in the state lives in a food insecure home by USDA definitions. Highly dependent as a state on SNAP or food stamps and WIC, women, infants, and children, two major feeding programs, supplemental feeding programs, and our economic performance really lags behind, I believe, every other state in the region. And so a lot of people see retaining more of our food dollar as well as creating more and new employment opportunities in the food sector as one of the ways to buttress and indeed grow the Maine economy for Mainers. Like Vermont, Maine's number one industry these days is tourism. And people want to see, and they certainly appreciate, working waterfronts as well as the working landscape that farms produce and provide. It's one of the very important non-priced benefits that farms create and also the seafood industry creates.
And as you were mentioning, part of the strategy isn't to exclude out-of-state products, but to include them,
right,
and make sure that they're available for the, but still supporting the same economy,
right,
that you want to be,
yes,
supporting.
We're also, at the very, very same time, we're working on the Maine food strategy. A number of us in the strategy also participate in Food Solutions New England, which is a group out of the University of New Hampshire's Sustainability Institute. And all of us in all of the six New England states are trying to create more viable food systems that are idiosyncratic in terms of meeting the needs of that of a particular state, but then working together with the other New England states to share information, knowledge, hopefully policy and investments. And it was interesting at this food summit, we had someone from one of the Canadian maritime provinces, because there is this very, very intimate linkage between northern New England, especially, and the maritime provinces. I mean, we work in one another's woods, we fish in one another's waters, we both grow potatoes, we're big dairy, apple producers, and we all root for the Red Sox. What more could you have?
And all the signs on the way up have kilometers as well.
Yes, that's true.
Well, thanks very much. It seems
my pleasure.
You're off to a good start.
Yeah.
Farmers on both sides of the lake, and in fact to have a whole region-wide agricultural identity. And it's called the Vermont Sail Freight Project. And the reason that I kind of have been, this has been nagging at me for a number of years, is that as farmers, we can produce food sustainably, often working very long hours and doing a very tough job, often in relative isolation, and the worth of our work may not be immediately apparent beyond the bounds of our communities. So I've been thinking of the Sail Freight Project as a way of taking our work and amplifying it and making it highly visible far beyond the borders of our farms. Also, the other point that the project makes is that merely producing food is only half of the job, and without equitable exchange and sustainable distribution, we've really only solved half of the problem. So really, I believe that in the North Country and New England of the future, that we have the ability, should we choose to do so, to power our economy with craft and with our backs and with animal power and with contemporary sunshine rather than ancient sunshine. So the Sail Freight Project is a way to begin to do that on a small but highly visible scale. This is one of building it as. It's a carbon neutral transport initiative that's connecting the farms and forests of Lake Champlain with the Lower Hudson Valley. And the boat in the background is more or less what we're building. Its name is Ceres, and Ceres is the goddess, the Roman goddess of grains and agriculture, and the woman who is on top of the Capitol Dome in Montpelier. She is 39 and a half feet long. She's just over 10 feet wide, and she holds 15 tons. She can be sailed with a crew of just two. And she's got a number of trade-friendly features. Having loaded many, many sacks of flour with my back and not enjoyed it, especially passing the 40-year mark, it has a number of mechanical advantage things, so we can actually move palletized cargo For instance, we could take palletized cargo off a flatbed truck and plunk it down in the hold just by ropes and pulleys and tackle. Here's just a sort of a roundup of the kinds of things we intend to ship. Very little in the way of things that require refrigeration. The basics are things that have a long shelf life. Coincidentally, these things that tend to have a long shelf life tend to be the same products that are in chronic undersupply in the New York City marketplace area, like dry beans and regional flour. So we feel that the market for those things under a marketed by sale label will be pretty good. It's not totally seasonal. We can't sail from January to March, but there are good possibilities that we can keep doing runs April through December. So maple syrup to Christmas trees. We can fit 600 bundled Christmas trees on the barge. So, yeah. So just imagine it all strung up with lights, you know, tied up near the batteries on Christmas trees. We have a gross registered tonnage of 14.92. There are U.S. Coast Guard inspection requirements that kick in at 15. So you can see we designed just shy of 15. 14.92 is less than 15. Nobody can argue with that. So we're uninspected. That's why it's costing us 18,000 to launch the boat and not 100. It's plywood with epoxy resin. Maybe the next generation will be building their barges out of hewn pine planks, but for now, it's awful easy to pick up the phone and the lumberyard truck shows up and it's got a whole stack of plywood on it. You can build a lot of barge in just a few days. You can run it with a crew of two. So why now? And the reason is, because I think we can do it. You know, the flippant answer is, like, if you live in New England and you get to be a certain age and you're male, you kind of have to choose between curmudgeon and nut job. curmudgeon didn't have its appeal to me, but in the end I decided that nut jobs have more fun. So I decided to towards nut jobs. So like I'm the nut job building the sailing barge. To be serious, we have a really simple design. We can build a barge that can do the job of a tractor trailer for much less than the purchase cost of a tractor trailer because it's extremely simplified. It's not a museum restoration piece. It's a rough and ready barge. We're going to use it hard. We're going to make it do work. And in 10 years, it's going to wear out. We'll run it up on a ledge and burn it and take the nails and build another one. So I feel that this is a concrete step towards resilience. It's an actual physical object, and it begins the learning process of learning to move heavy cargoes around the region on water. And we can do it now. It's a collaboration between farmers, including some on this side of the lake already, and the Willowell Foundation. The Willowell Foundation is an educational not-for-profit that's based in Moncton, Vermont. And I owe those guys a lot because they gave my project an organizational home and they allowed me to conduct it underneath their framework. When the Willowell Foundation tires of carrying my project and we devolve it from nonprofit to for-profit status, then that will be the opportunity to form a farmer-owned shipping and marketing cooperative. And that's really the vision that I have for this, is that this will be farmer-owned, that we will develop a new class of professional mariners who will work for the farmers. We could be transporting toasters on this. The idea would still be good, but it's basically food and farming centered. For me, this is about farming first, and it's about boat second. The boat is a means to an end.
Make sure to check out the launch of Ceres at Ferrisburg Town Beach outside of Vergennes, Vermont, on the afternoon of July 27th.
That does it for this episode of Food Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the folks at Royalton Community Radio. You can find our episodes streaming on their website, royaltonradio.org. Check out the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems page at vermontlaw.edu/CAFS. There you can download episodes and learn more about the CAF's mission. Please download our episodes on iTunes by searching for the Food Radio Collective and follow us on Twitter. We are at VT Food Radio. Food Talk Radio is a production of the Food Radio Collective. Our faculty director is Lori Restino. Contributions for this episode came from Will Duane, Jack Hornicle, and Emily Lyons. Music on today's show is from Bill Palmer, Jack Hornicle, and playing us out today is Young Yeller. Thanks for listening to Food Talk Radio. Farm, table, and everything in between.